Hey, Black and Published family, it's Nikisha. I want to say thank you for rocking with me these last few years. Over the course of these 5 seasons, I've shared with you the journeys of countless writers, including myself. I've told you about starting out as a self-published author and when my first nonfiction book came out in 2022. I have a new novel coming out in January entitled The 7 Daughters of Dupree. The story is a generational epic about the secrets kept between mothers and daughters over the course of 7 generations, told backwards in time from 1995 to 1860, and it's available for pre-order now, everywhere you get your books. I am beyond excited for this novel. It is my first Big 5 book, more on that later, and I'd like to make it a success, and I need your help to do that. If you can, please consider pre-ordering The 7 Daughters of Dupree today. Now let's get to the episode.
The arts have been my oxygen. The arts have been my guiding light, always.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published on the Mahogany Books Podcast Network, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Laura Pegram, the editor of Sing the Truth, the Quaylee Journal short story collection. The anthology comes 15 years after Quaylee debuted as the premier online literary journal focused on nurturing the voices of emerging writers who identify as Black, Indigenous, or as other people of color.
This very well-planned attack is meant to try to erase us, but that will not succeed. Though there is this concentrated effort to ban and censor, we will not be silenced.
Laura, as the founding editor of Quaylee, said she was struck with the idea to start the journal when she was in the hospital and could barely move due to her autoimmune disease. Why, at her weakest moments, she held tight to creating a life of literary arts. Plus, how she's reframing the notion that for writers, rejection is the rule. And how she chose the 14 stories in the collection from 15 years worth of submissions. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. Laura, when did you know that you were a writer?
Oh my, from the time I was writing poetry in elementary school, I think that's when I knew. I would be called to the stage to recite the poems that I had written and be a nervous wreck, but still manage somehow to get through it. But that's when I believe I knew that I had a gift.
And so in knowing that you had a gift at such a young age, how did that carry you throughout life? Did you always know you wanted to make a life of literature?
I knew that I wanted to have art as part of my life, but I also had an interest in the sciences. And I think that was partly due to the fact that my mom had autoimmune disease and I wanted to find a way to help her. And I thought I could do that if I went towards the sciences and became a doctor. So I wanted to be able to do both, kind of blend the art with the science. So be the writer and the physician. I sadly lost my mom from a very early age. She was in her 40s. And it was one of the most challenging times for me and my siblings. The other thing that made it difficult as we got older was knowing that we also had a predisposition to autoimmunity. And my younger sister, I suppose, has more complications than any of us in that she had back-to-back strokes in her 30s, lost partial vision in one eye, has had multiple surgeries. It's been difficult to manage, but somehow or other, we're learning to live with it. And we're just trying to do the best we can with the cards that we were dealt.
And you talk about that in the intro to Sing the Truth about how it was when you were coming out of the hospital and you could barely move that you kind of made this decision that, you know what, I'm going to make a life of literature.
Yes.
What was that,
I guess, watershed moment where it was then where you could do barely anything else that you decided that you were going to go after something that you had loved for so long?
I needed some light to hold on to. It was one of the darkest moments in my life. I was in a wheelchair. The folks that would come in and out of my home during the day tried to assist me the best they could, from the nurse to the home care assistant to the physical therapist, who would say, just try to move your leg, like, this would be our goal for today. And when I couldn't do it, he would try to keep my spirits up. But I needed something more than that, right? I needed something that would keep me going, carry me forward, even if the prognosis was poor. And for me, that has always been the arts. The arts have been my oxygen. The arts have been my guiding light, always. And so I thought, well, what if I can do something from home? I could no longer work at the community arts center. That was my second home after my 9-to-5. I would go uptown to the arts center. I couldn't do that anymore. The only time I left my apartment was when the Windsor Ambulance Service would carry me up and down my 5 flights of stairs to and from the hospital, and that's it. And that's all I could really swing, because it was $200 each way, cash, $200 each way to and from the hospital. I was newborn baby weak, and so I really couldn't entertain the idea of doing anything more than that, right? It took all the energy I could muster, along with a helping hand, just to get me dressed, to get me into the wheelchair, get me out of the house, and then get me back so I could fall out. That in itself was enough to knock me out cold. But yeah, I needed some light to keep me going, because I was in a difficult place.
What about Black literature is a light for you?
Black literature is home. It shores me up. Toni Morrison, in her Noble lecture, said that literature was like vitamins, right? Mm. They're vitamins. The poetry, the literature, the songs are full of vitamins. And I needed those vitamins to get strong. I needed those vitamins to shore me up for those times when life threw you a curveball that you weren't quite expecting. Because if anything, autoimmunity is about unpredictability. And I needed to be able to handle it whenever things went south, right? So whenever I went from being stable one minute to unstable the next, I needed to be able to handle it, right? To be able to ask the right questions of the doctors before they brought me into surgery, to be able to manage the question marks, because there were always more questions than not. We'll try this new med. We'll try this new approach. I remember once being told, well, we'll try this chemotherapy drug to see if we can bring down your immune system, and maybe that will be the way. And it's like, you find another way, because that does not sit right with me.
See? You don't even have cancer.
Thank you. Thank you.
I was like, wait, what?
Right, right. That was my response. I said, I understand that my immune system is on fire and it's out of control, but there has to be another way to bring it down than to give me chemotherapy.
Because right? Chemotherapy will wipe it out. Yeah. Yeah.
So find another way. Yeah, let's try that. Let's try that. Another way.
That's wild. Mm-hmm. Oh, the American medical system. Jesus.
Yeah. But it's still being used, right? Chemo is still being used to bring down autoimmunity in cases that are difficult or challenging. Yeah, they're still using that.
And so at this like nadir point in your life, mm-hmm. you decide from home mm-hmm. to start a literary journal.
Yeah. Yeah. I needed to be able to focus on something besides the head pain, besides poor prognosis. I needed something tangible. And that came to me like in between sleep and wake, which is when most of my ideas come, in between like 3 and 4 in the morning, 3 and 4:30 in the morning.
The writer's time.
Yes. 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 And I said, okay, I don't know how to do this, but I'm going to try. And I held on to that idea for 2 years until I was able to realize it. And we launched our first issue.
So what did that look like? Because like, I mean, I'm used to talking to authors about the generative process for a novel, but you are incubating a journal that could be a home for authors, but that can very much outlive you, right? Mm-hmm. And leave a lasting legacy of literature. I mean, you already have. We're 15 years in and you have your short story collection now that we're celebrating today with Sing the Truth. So in those 2 years that you were incubating and generating this idea, what did that look like to go from idea to like accepting entries and submissions and putting out your very first issue?
I first reached out to some of my colleagues from the Community Arts Center and asked them if they could help me, because I knew I needed like a circle, a family around me to help me get this off of the ground. And they all said yes. And I'm grateful beyond measure, from the colleagues who used to teach alongside me to students who were in the workshops learning and developing their craft. Each of them said yes. It's like, tell us where you want us to be and we're there. And to their credit, they stayed for the opening years, I would say for the first 3 years with me. I couldn't pay them, didn't have a dime, but we were a small but mighty army, a small but mighty team of folks, from Michelle Marriott, who was a board member, to Nicole Vasquez, who was one of the editors, to Trine Adams, another editor, like just joys in my life who stepped up when they heard the call go out. From there, we started accepting submissions through the mail and started making decisions. And Princess Joy L. Perry and Ivelisse Rodriguez were two of the first authors in our inaugural issue. It was a joy to have them to complement nonfiction work and poetry by Nelly Azadio and Patricia Spears Jones. It was a proud moment.
What have these authors said to you 15 years in about what it meant to be a part of Clayleigh's inception?
Wow. I talked to Princess Perry about this recently because she came to New York for one of the book launches. She lives in Virginia. And she says, do you realize how many lives you have changed? Do you know this? And I had to pause for a second because I don't usually stop to think. Right. But when she was going through the book and kind of flipping the pages, and she said, I read this cover to cover. Do you understand? And this is just a fraction of the writers that you have worked with and that you have published. Do you know what you've done? And I kind of got caught off guard by that question, because it's not often that I have time to sit and think about what I've done, because the work is, it's always growing exponentially with each day, right? Because we still have a very small team, you have to wear multiple hats, working 7 days a week. It's a lot to carry, but it makes my heart sing to know that I've made a difference and that Clayleigh will hopefully continue to make a difference in the world of publishing.
So speaking of the world of publishing, Clayleigh serves as a platform that a lot of writers, emerging writers, can turn to try to submit their work and begin to build their byline and eventually their author brand. And you all, as the journal, have gone through author's equity, which is like a new concept to put this collection out. Can you talk about what that partnership has been like with author's equity in publishing this collection?
Oh, it's been a joy times 20. I am overjoyed to know that you can have a true collaboration with your publishing partner, that they are open to every idea that you propose. I remember during one of our team meetings, and we would meet monthly to prepare for the publication and talk about where we were and what we had ahead and look at the deadline dates going forward for either the submission of my introduction or the submission of the recordings for the book. Everything was calendared. And one time, before the audiobook was even mentioned, someone said, the contract doesn't touch the audiobook, but it's something we should definitely have. And within minutes, they said yes. There was no pause. There was no, let me consider the budget and we'll get back to you. It just became, okay, it's in motion. Laura, I need you to contact each of the authors, let them know that the contract is going to be modified. We're adding the audiobook and we need their approval right away. Because then we had to schedule the actors. Once we secured the actors for the audiobooks, we then had to schedule the recordings. So everything was constantly in motion. It was an eye-opening experience to know that you had the full support of your publishing family to get this book out and to make it the work of art that you had originally envisioned it.
I know there's been a lot of conversation lately about author's equity in terms of it being like a new intermediary publishing model that has a more profit-sharing model for the authors who are with them. Mm-hmm. The word that comes to mind is disrupting, but in a good way. Like Quailee is a journal that disrupts the industry because it allows a specific place for authors and writers of color. And author's equity is disruptive to the traditional publishing marketplace in that it is more collaborative, not only in the way that they work, but also in the way that they share profits and do things like that. So in that mindset, how do you think your work and then partnering with Authors Equity has continued to shift the marketplace so that it is more open to voices that have traditionally had a hard time getting through?
I think Authors Equity has a model which embraces the best of traditional publishing and then the most innovative and experimental models at the same time. And that's what I love, right? So when I met with editors who had expressed an interest in the anthology, I did not hesitate before I said, AE is where I want to be, right? It was clear after talking to the entire team and listening to their ideas, which were all carefully considered. They were excited and energized about the book. They were excited and energized about working with me. I already knew at least one of the members of the team, Robin Desser, who is the editor for Edwige Dandicott. We had met at an event with Edwige and became fast friends. So I already felt as if there was a certain level of trust here. And moving forward, I thought about all the possibilities for other authors of color, right? And to be nurtured and guided and to be cared for from the second we walked in and said, okay, we're off. We are going to do this thing. It has been the most heartwarming experience. And I felt there was no better place for truth to be birthed.
How did you choose the stories in the anthology with so many submissions over the years?
The hardest thing ever, to choose 14 stories out of all the ones to consider. I would keep going back every couple of weeks and saying, just three more. Can we consider three more? And then a couple of days or the next day say, just two more. And I promise won't give you So eventually they had to say, okay, Laura, we understand, but no more. Can I consider another story? But it was the most difficult because all of them are my babies, right? And it's hard to choose from your babies, which one is going to be selected and which ones are going to be kind of left to the side. I didn't want anyone to feel as if I love them less.
Yeah.
I love each of them. So having to choose some and not others was excruciatingly difficult.
How have you seen the stories and the submissions change over the years? I wonder, because Quailee has been in existence for so long now, do you see more of a freedom on the page in the work that is submitted?
I think we've always seen freedom on the page from day one. I think there's been a substantial change. It's in the number of submissions with those free works of art, right? The number of submissions has just grown immeasurably. And that's probably the largest change from all corners of the world. We've always had, from the beginning, submissions from inside the country and outside, but the numbers have grown. The numbers have grown. We've been working with writers on their craft who were based in Kenya. One of the first international fellows was Kiprop Kemute, and that was in maybe 2016, 2017. And now he's about to publish his debut novel next year with Grey Wolf. It's been a joy to work with writers globally.
How do you handle it all still being a relatively small nonprofit?
That's a challenge. That is a challenge. I suppose I keep holding on to the dream that eventually we will have the support that we need. We will have a physical space. Right now, my home feels like it's the Quayle office more than it is Laura's sanctuary. I have boxes of books. I have boxes of files that have spelled out. They're overflowing from the two-drawer file cabinet that I had. They're in makeshift boxes and piles around my home. So I'm looking forward to the day when I have a real space for Quayle, and then I can have my home back. I'm also looking forward to the day when we have full-time staff support. Right now, I'm the only full-time person, and we have three part-time folks who help me as my right arm, right leg. They do it all. Whenever there's a need, they pitch in. And then the volunteers who are also willing to do whatever it takes to make sure the Quayle moves forward in as smooth a fashion as we can. One day we'll get there. So I'm trying to keep my eyes set on that day.
And so in thinking about keeping your eyes set on that day, what does this moment of publishing this anthology mean for you personally, but also for Quayle 15 years in and looking for that day where you have permanent space and full-time office staff and you get your home back and maybe can take a break or vacation?
Oh my goodness, a vacation would be welcome. More than a day or two off would be lovely, because usually if I'm taking a day or two off, I'm taking the computer with me and I'm still working. So it's just a change of scene. Maybe I'm going to my sister's place or my brother's place, but I'm still working. So it's not really a vacation, but I'm looking forward to all the things. But it is such a joy to have Sing the Truth in my hand, and I still pick it up and just stare at it as if I just received the box of books just this morning. And I just stare at what was possible, what was made possible, and the lives that have been changed, the careers that have been created. And I kind of get emotional all over again. You know, it's a beautiful thing to have this tangible book, this physical book to hold, to celebrate, to share. There are times when I still feel as if Quayle is this underground entity. There are pockets of people here and there that know of us who submit work to us. But I still feel as if there are a large number of folks who still don't quite know who we are and what we do and what we plan to do in the future. So hopefully this book will help change that.
With that said, I could think of no more perfect time than to have you read something from Sing the Truth, if you want to read something from your intro.
Oh my goodness. I would be happy to. Thank you.
Sing the Truth, the Quayle Journal short story collection, edited by Laura Pegram, comprises 14 stories from authors including Nicole Dennis-Benn, Caitlin Greenidge, Naima Koster, and more, about the devastation of leaving home, reimagining life or death, and exploring the human experience, whether that's in the American South, the Global South, or beyond. And often, with children as the main protagonist driving the narratives forward for change. Here's Laura.
I'll read the last two paragraphs. In her essay, The Sight of Memory, Toni Morrison writes, "The act of imagination is bound up with memory. You know, they straightened out the Mississippi River in places to make room for houses and livable acreage. Occasionally, the river floods these places, remembering the before time. Writers are like that, remembering where we were, what valley we ran through, what the banks were like, the light that was there, and the route back to our original place. It is emotional memory," she writes. "For me, it's one that calls back all the notes of an imagined life, the hardship, but also the hope. So come, sit with us on the bank and listen to our music.
I love that you talk about the hope that is to come, because so many of the stories in the collection center children and what their lives are like, good, bad, or indifferent. And often, as Whitney's saying, you know, the children are the hope of the future.
Right.
And so selecting the stories for the collection, was that a conscious decision to have so many of these like young coming of age stories in the anthology?
It wasn't intentional, but I was only looking for stories that had multiple narratives that called and pulled at me from the first moment I read them and continued to have that same power. And while that is true for everything that I published, there's something about the stories with the children. Like, I come from a family of nine. I was the second oldest. So when my mom would be working the graveyard shift at the factory, I would be there with my older sibling to make sure everyone was okay. So I suppose I have a strong love for stories with child narrators, and a lot of them end up on the workshop reading list. And it's funny that you're the second person who asked me about that, like the number of stories with children at the center was not at all intentional. They're just the pieces that tugged at my heartstrings, I suppose.
We like what we like. I think my favorite story in the collection is definitely Emperor of the Universe, because it has all the ingredients that I like in a story. Like, it was set in New Orleans, so it's very familiar to me because that's where my family is from. Then the vast funerary rites and how people mourn and grieve and or celebrate life. All of that was there on the page. And then reading it, it was so inventive and imaginative, but also a little morbid and disturbing. But I understood her. And so I was like, I get where you're coming from, sis.
Yes. When I first read that story, I said, oh my goodness, definite yes, right? And I was surprised as well. But when you're reading a story and when you're writing a story, you're told not to judge the character, right? You just try to understand them. And I understood her. I understood her choices. I understood her reasons for doing what she did. I felt for her and her, you know? So yes, Caitlin's story will always be like tugging at the heart too.
In putting this collection together and doing all the different works that you do for Quaylee through the journal and publishing different writers to the workshops and series and even the mentorship programs that you all do that get really intensive and go for weeks. How do you see your contribution to the literary landscape, especially in this time where the arts and literature and books, especially those by Black folk and people of color and queer folk and people of so many other identities and like cishet white, are really under attack?
I think it's even more important now with the attacks against our histories, our stories, our visual art. I think that this very well-planned attack is meant to try to erase us, but that will not succeed. We will continue pushing forward in the same way that our ancestors found a way, despite many obstacles, despite many hurdles, despite not having all the answers, they still found a way forward. And we're going to do the same. We're not going to allow anyone to take away our truth, to take away our history, even though there is this concentrated effort to ban and censor. We will not be silenced.
So then with that sentiment and refusing to bow down to this fascism and authoritarianism and the cultural genocide that is happening, what is next for you and for Quaylee?
We're going to keep doing what we've always done. We're going to keep lifting up artists. We're going to keep showcasing their work. We're going to keep centering the histories that have long been buried or kicked to the curb. We're going to keep telling the stories that will fortify us, the histories that have taught us. We're going to keep embracing the voices and nurturing the artists that are equally committed to telling the truth.
And that commitment to nurturing those artists, to telling the truth and having the collection that you do as a testament to what that truth telling looks like. What do you want this next generation cohort of writers to get from the work that you've done so far that is encapsulated in Sing the Truth?
I want them to know what's possible. There are a few artists that told me there were points in time when they thought about stopping, when they considered giving up, because they said rejection was the rule and they didn't know that this dream would actually be possible or attainable. And I told them that you will keep going forward because yes is right around the corner. So if I want folks to know anything, is that they have to persevere, that there will always be moments where no is the response from some, but it only takes one yes. And I have said this to so many writers over the years. It only takes one yes. And if that yes is coming from someone or from a group of people who are truly invested in your story and your art, then that's the best you could hope for, right? If they're going to help you center your work, introduce it to the public, help you celebrate it when it's published and in bookstores, help you grow as an artist with the second book and the fifth book and the 10th book, that's a gift. You know you're not on this journey alone. You have your sisters and brothers in the community. You have the publishers who are extended members of your publishing family, of your heart family often. You have the support that you need when you start to have doubts, and every author has them, particularly when they're approaching the blank page to start the next book. Edward P. Jones said that you're not able to take all of those awards and all of those accolades with you when you're looking at a blank page and say, okay, work, help me write this, right? You're starting at the bottom of the mountain and you have to be able to push yourself forward and up even when you have doubts about whether or not you can do this, if this idea is going to actually fly, if you're going to be able to really make it work, right? So keep going, trust yourself, trust your gut, and know that you're not alone, right? You always have the ancestors by your side. You always have a close and core group of readers who will tell you honestly when you have hit a home run on the page and when you need to maybe revisit a few passages. And you need that honest voice. You don't need someone who's essentially telling you everything is wonderful and it's perfect, because you can't always see where the holes lie, even when you're making a concerted effort to be emotionally distant enough from the page to be able to see, you don't always know how to fix it, right? So that's when a close reader or a third eye comes in handy.
Thank you. I needed that. I don't know about anybody else listening, but I needed that. I appreciate it. Thank you.
You're so welcome. You're so welcome. My pleasure.
So before we go today, I want to do a quick speed round in the game before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
I'd probably have to start with Beloved. And then I'd have to say Edwige Dandekot's collection of short stories, The Dewbreaker, and then her newest collection of short stories that was published 2 years ago. Alward P. Jones, The Known World, mm-hmm. and his, it's hard to say the first or second collection of short stories because I love both of them and I use them often. And can I have six?
Go for it. Go for it.
Okay. The Love Songs of W.E.B. Du Bois by Honoré Fanon-Jeffers. Oh, but there's so many more titles. Like, oh my God, this is difficult.
Equally as difficult. Who is your favorite author?
Stop. Stop. Oh. Goodness gracious. I'm going to say Toni Morrison because June Jordan introduced me to her art. I did not know of her work before college, even though she's on reading lists in high school, not my high school. So I was grateful to see our voice, our stories, our histories on the page in Toni Morrison's novel. And I think the first one that June had given me as a gift, I was in the hospital and I was an inpatient and come in with a stack of books, flowers, and jokes that would have me laughing in stitches, even if I was in incredible pain. Somehow she managed that each and every time with each and every admission. So I would say Toni because Toni was probably the first one that I recall seeing and celebrating like our stories, our language, our histories. And I'd not seen that prior.
Who is your favorite poet?
Nikki Finney.
And what is your favorite song?
There's a song by Donny Hathaway. And I think it's This Song's For You.
A Song For You.
A Song For You. Yeah.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
I would go back to Bahia. I went to Bahia to study capoeira for a book project I was working on and fell in love. I loved the culture, the history, the friends I made who immediately adopted me into the family. I loved the music. I loved listening to the wave splash. I loved even falling in capoeira. falling and hitting the ball in capoeira in my first class because I'd never studied the form before and having to do a handstand and throw a kick. Oh my gosh. But loved it. And what was the other part of the question?
What would you do and where would you live?
I would like to live either in Bahia, because I studied Portuguese, or go back and live in Paris and sing and write and be the artist and maybe still the editor too. And do all the things I loved.
A full renaissance in Paris. I love it.
Yes, yes, yes.
Name three things on your bucket list.
I would love to be able to walk again unassisted. I would love to be able to travel again the way I used to. Three, I would love to spend time with the people in my heart more regularly, both my family and my created family. And that's harder to do now for so many reasons.
What brings you joy?
Oh, a child's laughter immediately brings me joy. A song that I can replay again and again and again and again. And being around people who know me and see me and love me, all of that brings me joy.
What brings you peace?
A book or books, plural. A walk in the park is usually preferable because being around nature is just always so soothing, even when the day can be draining with this never-ending cycle of news that can bring one to their knees. And knowing that I'm not alone, even if I'm in my apartment alone, I'm not alone. That I always have the protection of the ancestors. I always have folks who are watching over me. And that's what gets me through.
And who as an author do you admire most?
Oh, another difficult one. You have to give folks more than one choice. Oh my gosh.
I didn't limit you to a restriction.
Oh my goodness, we could go on for hours here. I'd probably say June Jordan, because she taught me to see my strength, to know it, and to see the sky as my ceiling. Her memoir is one that I repeatedly return to, The Soldier's Story. And she told me bits and pieces about her childhood and growing up time, but the book outlined it in great detail. So what's survivable, I think, is also good to know, right? Yeah. What we have survived as a people, you know, what we can survive.
Yeah. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics, and classic is however you define it. And you can do write or edit for this one. What's the one book you wish you would have written or edited?
Wow. Bones by Jessamine Ward.
Salvage the Bones?
By Jessamine Ward.
Yes.
She's another author in that top three, top 20. Yes. Jessamine Ward. Oh my God.
Name one book where you want to change the ending, and how would you do it?
Oh, change the ending. I don't know that I've read a book where I wanted to change the ending. Maybe in one of the books that I wrote, I would have wanted to change the ending for one of my picture books. The first book that I wrote, and I would have changed how the little girl at the center of the story, her conflict, because it was resolved too quickly by others, which is not quite as satisfactory when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I would have wanted to revise that, edit that.
Okay. So my messy question, name a book, that you think is overrated or overtaught and why? And you can do dead people.
Okay. Overrated, overtaught. A book that bored me senseless. I'm struggling to find the title, but I met June in my freshman year. So after I met June and she started introducing me to our work, you know, I moved away from the work of dead white men, which is what was predominantly on the reading list for this English 101 class that I dropped. I dropped it within the first few weeks. It was just not serving me. And yeah, I was bored. I had no interest in any of the works that this instructor celebrated. And then I met June. It's like, okay, well, I found my home. Now I feel home. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so much so but that you don't even remember the book. I love that.
Wow. I remember that I was completely bored out of my mind. And it's like, why am I spending time with these lives, right? No interest. Drop that course. That's the only class that I ended up dropping. I usually start whatever I finish. Mm-hmm. So in that instance, I said, no, thank you.
All right. That's a word. My final question for you today. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
That I helped new writers find their song, that I helped them sing.
Big thank you to Laura Pegram for being here today on Black and Published. You can follow Laura and Kwei Lee on the socials at kweilee.journal on Instagram and Threads. And Kwei Lee is spelled K-W-E-L-I. And make sure you check out Sing the Truth. It's out now from Authors Equity. You can get a copy of the collection from Mahogany Books and get 10% off your first purchase using code BLACKPUB at checkout. That's BLKPUB. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Laura about how her editorial eye has sharpened over the years and what that means for the writers she works with. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Rachel Housel Hall, author of the thriller Fog and Fury.
I like the idea of putting Black women in spaces where the majority in that surrounding, in that setting, finds her intrusive, finds her to be a problem. They are seen as disruptors and upsetting the status quo around them. That's my brand. When readers pick up my book, they don't know how I'm going to jack up their world, but they do know that my character will be her.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.
What's going on, family? This is Derek Young.
And Ramonda Young.
Owners of both Mahogany Books and the Mahogany Books Podcast Network.
We really want to thank each and every one of you for listening to this episode. And if you enjoyed what you just heard, drop us a review and rate us on whatever platform you download podcasts on.
We truly appreciate each and every one of you for supporting us and making us your go-to for Black books. And we look forward to connecting with you all sometime in the future.
Thank you again, fam. And always remember, Black books matter.